We are back. Joe, how are you doing?
I'm just fine, Tim. How are you?
Very well. Well, more death and destruction in Gaza. This week, the Biden administration actually criticized the government of Bibi Netanyahu for the apparent targeting of six foreign national aid workers and a Palestinian translator. These were they're working for I think it was World Central Kitchen. Humanitarian operation that was providing aid to the beleaguered and besieged people of Gaza. And of course, Israel claimed it was an accident. Of course, there was a I think a three-staged attack, like the USS Liberty. Whoops, whoops, and whoops. Clearly marked vehicles. Of course, Israel has said that they don't want aid workers operating independent of the IDF in Gaza, and they want them out. And so, lo and behold, they're murdered. It's one way to get them out, even if aid is provided, there's no one to distribute it in Gaza, because when people show up to get food, they get massacred, and now the aid workers are being massacred. I think Israel has killed or accidentally killed 200 aid workers since October 7th, or close to it. So it's quite an accident. So it's clearly it was targeted. It was the weapon they used is GPS guided, but nevertheless, although the Biden administration is claiming there's no evidence that it was intentional, other than the fact that there's seven people dead. I think
Well,
that would
other than
be evidence, wouldn't
the
it?
fact that they did use GPS guided
Yes.
weapons, and that they have satellite surveillance of the area at a very fine detail, and perfectly knew who this group was,
Yeah.
and then and have said prior, as you pointed out, that they want these people out. So it's it's this typical, the Israelis are operating in kind of a Deuteronomy religious genocide, perspective. That I think is an honest description of what they are, doing, how they're conducting the war. The Biden administration then, its role is to create the illusion that there is some kind of contestation or means of protesting this, because they become upset from time to time with what Netanyahu is doing. But obviously, if they were truly upset, they would do something like cut off the aid,
Yeah,
cut off the
one of
support.
the I think one of them was an American volunteer.
Yeah, but you see, the fact is, this is just sophistry. This is just propaganda. The Biden administration's protests are just there to create the idea that Israel and the government of the United States are not a single entity, but they are, and the protests are just propaganda to keep the public from becoming aware of that fact.
Well, yeah, I think coinciding with this latest slaughter on by the Israelis, $15 billion in dollar additional aid was approved. 25 jet fighters were sent. And I mean, just print the money up and send the hardware over there. This is done by the administration unilaterally without any congressional approval. Although Congress, I would think, would be loath to question it because they're as controlled as the White House by AIPAC. And the Jewish lobby,
Yeah,
so
of
that's the
course.
problem. We Americans who are against this have no representation in government at this point,
All right.
effectively.
There was an example of that this week, where Marjorie Greene was criticizing Johnson, the Speaker of the House, claiming that his behavior gave her the impression that he was being blackmailed. In other words, he had caved in on every single purported Republican issue, right? And of course, he's slavish to Israel. And she came up with a theory that, well, this guy, they have to have something on him in order for him to change so dramatically. But you see, she's naive. I mean, the fact is, he is part of the group. You see, this is the thing, is that without understanding the simple concept of lifetime actor, of someone who pretends to be something that they're not, right? That she has to come up with like complicated theories, and she can't really organize an effective kind of critical publicity against this guy. She should be saying, he is in and of himself fake. We want DNA analysis of who his family members are to see exactly how it is he has come to this position of power, and promote the idea of the lifetime actor, because you know, the public is defenseless, in my opinion, without the concept. They don't understand that the first way of looking at people like Trump or Mitch McConnell or Biden, you know, and particularly their relationship to Israel, is that, well, you know, there is this problem historically in Europe of what I call generally the converso, which is, you know, actually a term applied to, you know, the Jews that converted in Spain, but yeah. I'm applying it to all of Europe. You see, I'm broadening.
Well, yeah, it's an ongoing thing,
right?
and we'll talk about it. They convert to any number of ideologies and positions.
But anyway, I would just say someone like Johnson, the way to look at him is that, well, let's look in your family background, because your behavior is not coherent as a Gentile. But if you are an agent, if you are, you know, just someone who is using your Gentile identity as a way to get votes and get in a position of power and to deceive us, then suddenly your behavior just is perfect, perfectly comprehensible. And I've talked about this a number of times. You've got to, in our world where history and news are controlled and are used against us, we have to use logic and try to make sure that we don't fall for narratives or individuals who are inexplicable. When it's inexplicable, we need to like switch frameworks. We need to try to look at, you know, other theories of the origin of these things and try to come up with frameworks that are actually logical and realistic. Johnson, as a family who is, you know, as a converso, who is a shill, who is representing the interests of Israel because he's part of this tribe, his behavior becomes coherent. But this is a theory, right? And of course, there are ways to demonstrate it. Just see if you'd be willing to give us a DNA sample.
Well, at the very least, both Marjorie Taylor Greene and Johnson are Christian Zionists, either consciously or by default. That's the default position. I have many right-wing Christians, many Catholic, and they default to the Christian Zionist philo-Semitic position, because that's just the default position of 21st century America, of 20th century America. So it's been that way for better part of a century. So,
the important attribute is just that Johnson has political power. This is the thing which is unusual and needs explanation.
Well, he wouldn't have political power if he was critical of Israel. Right? Touché. We can't have that. That's right. Within the Overton window, if you will.
Right. They wouldn't put people into power that were capable of criticism.
Yeah, I mean, wasn't his first statement of speaker an oath of fealty to Israel? as you would expect. Ted Cruz's 4th of July, I think, message to his constituents was praising Israel.
Right. I mean, and bear in mind that little country, you know, like 5,000 miles from us, is just central to all of the problems on our streets and in our, you know, on our main streets. I mean, it's obviously that this is some kind of vast propaganda meme to control the minds of Gentiles into, you know, seeing themselves in this happy relationship with this the chosen people, but in fact, it's all leading up to a kind of slavery and then genocide.
Yeah, and of course, this week you also had Israel took it upon itself to launch an airstrike that demolished Iran's consulate in Damascus, Syria, killing two Iranian generals and five officers, reportedly. Of course, the Iranian consulate is sovereign territory, and from what I understand, so is Syria. But nevertheless, Israel took it upon itself to bomb two sovereign countries, and now they're talking, I hope this doesn't expand the war. Well, this is an expansion of the war, but then they're worrying about it, retaliation. Well, what would you expect? And of course, that retaliation will be treated as aggression, because it will occur a couple weeks later.
Yeah, terrorism. Yeah. I mean, they are incapable, and it's a kind of sophistry that they use against us, but it is impossible to start a discussion about their misbehavior. Because they are never misbehaving, because they are always counter.
Well, because there's a pile of shoes in Auschwitz.
Right. That's right.
Look at the pile of shoes.
Gigantic. Right.
I think every Jew should carry like a pair of empty shoes with them. So anytime you have a disagreement, they just pull it out of a bag and show you.
There it is, that giant pile of shoes. And that's kind of how the whole it's this.
Yeah.
It is and just how, you know, we've talked about what a powerful intellectual structure it is. I mean, this is a great example where ultimately they can bomb this, you know, sovereign region and then claim that, well, we are just trying to defend ourselves. And if you say, well, that's impossible, you know, they're just sitting there, you know, what are you talking about? Eventually it gets to the Holocaust. Mm-hmm. It's like, well, think about, you know, what we have to deal with in a general sense because of the suffering we put in since the Holocaust, which is why I would just say anyone who hasn't read Garmar Rudolph's encyclopedia, who doesn't have it available, or Butz's The Great Hoax of the 20th Century, both of these things are online, for heaven's sakes. I mean,
yes,
you've got to have that foundational information so that when these wave after wave of sophistry of, you know, well, you know, Gentiles are always bad, we're always defending ourselves, boy, you have to have that information to use these criticisms when they come into play as a point of as a teaching moment, and try to explain to whoever is, you know, abused by this misinformation of the truth of the Holocaust, how it was just a propaganda, you know, structure, and that there the evidence for it, if you actually like go through Rudolph's book, I mean, it just disappears. I mean, there was certainly camps, there was forced labor, but the idea that there was, you know, mass extermination with gas chambers is just not there. The evidence doesn't exist. So when they bring that up as a way to justify, well, you know, the destruction of the Palestinians, you know, you have to have the foundational information to just call them on it. And we have to try to, you know, get in our people inside of the Gentile world an automatic reaction of whenever the Holocaust is publicized as a rationale for violence by the Israelis or Jews' political undemocratic power. You've got to start the process. You have to always take the heat, and just, you know, that they're going to attack you as anti-Semitic, but just demand that their use of the Holocaust lead to a discussion of the Holocaust, you know, instead of like you leading to intimidation and we can't talk, I can't think, we have to go along with whatever they're telling us. Always try to take it to a discussion of the evidence for the Holocaust, because if this becomes common, I mean, their storyline, as you know, is so weak that it'll just disappear, and then they will be exposed, and we can.
Well, that's why they're making it a delit or illegal to question it or even engage in any discussion about it. That's why they have to put people in jail in Europe. And in the United States, effectively, if you have any position of influence, you will be your life will be ruined. And, you know, if you doubt that, just look at the experience of Fred Luchter, who provided, I think, was an expert witness for Ernst Sundahl. And Ernst Sundahl was put on trial for simply publishing a newsletter. He was deported from Canada. And then he was thrown into solitary confinement, thrown into jail just for voicing his opinion on a historical matter or topic. Then Germar Rudolph also was brought in to back up the research of Fred Luchter. He was a chemist, and his life was ruined. He was thrown into jail. What power structure did that? I mean, not only that power structure was not only was able to ruin their lives, they were able to suborn or manipulate multiple governments, multiple bureaucracies, and the court system to harass and ruin these people's lives just to maintain a lousy narrative. And they didn't engage these people in debate. They called them names and had their lives ruined. And engaged in all types of illegal, like things like, you know, tortious interference. These things are illegal, but no one brings up a RICO case against ADL. You know, just this past V-Day was shut down in New York. I guess they were incorporated in New York for some reason. Letitia James, citing no legal cause, harassed them just through lawfare. And if we were a country of laws, or a country where there is a meaningful political opposition, the Republicans or conservatives would be initiating all types of legislative and political counterattacks, including a RICO a case, maybe, and even the Bar Association in New York would disbar Letitia James for abuse of power. But there's, right. it's just crickets. And this isn't. Yeah. And VDare is a moderate, like a alternative right wing website. Yeah. They just questioned immigration. It was that guy from National Review who started it, Peter Brimelow. And so, but this stuff is tolerated.
I don't think any legitimate Gentile intellectual, public figure intellectual, should have anything other as a platform for every single, position on anything, on pedagogy and elementary schools that doesn't start with, a declaration of Holocaust revisionism.
Well, that should be a good, it should be required in every class.
It should be required. And every public figure and any kind of public intellectual that the Gentiles have, whatever they are.
This is where I'm agreeing with the IHRA and ADL. There should be in every curriculum, every school should be Holocaust education, not Holocaust miseducation, Holocaust education.
Yeah.
And what that word means.
And Holocaust discussion. I mean, you see, if there was like a 500 public intellectuals, people that are quasi well known for putting out thoughtful, analysis on stuff, if they were all every time that they had, kind of public discussion or some sort of media exposure, they mentioned Holocaust revisionism, then we could quickly transition from, where it is now, where it is tipping. You look at the statistics on the percentage of young people, mm-hmm. particularly who don't buy it. You could move really quickly into basically open intellectual warfare, where they would just be trying to shut up every single one of these people. And the more they do, the more public, kind of clamping down on free speech they do, the more diminishing returns will occur, and the more people will go, I'm going to look into this. Because let's face it, Tim, I mean, Rudolph's material is online. If this should be the most attended website in the world. If that website becomes just an information he's got there, if it becomes, just vastly understood, the Holocaust narrative will disappear. Moreover, the whole kind of camouflage malevolence of Jewish political power will be exposed. You see, so this is this is a critical time, and this
well,
is
that's why the ADL and the Jewish Commissars took over, or they already controlled Google, but they manipulated the algorithms so these things are effectively shadow banned online. You can't
exactly find,
and that's kind of the story of Twitter and TikTok. They're trying to destroy TikTok or take it over. But Twitter and Facebook and all that manipulation, they couldn't get your YouTube, some years ago was destroyed as a free speech platform. And, so that's why their commissars are all like trying to control everything, because they can't really engage, despite their supposed higher verbal IQ, they can't contend in any open debate on the matter.
Right. They have really high verbal IQ, but they can't talk to anyone about anything that's real. That makes a lot of sense.
That's
makes
great.
A lot of sense.
Yeah. So in the end, the burn your house down assassination. Okay. Well, last week rather, or I guess it was this week. It was Easter Sunday. Biden used Easter holiday to proclaim Trans Visibility Day in an official proclamation. March 31st, then he denied doing it. I think he actually forgot that he did it. I don't think he signs these documents anyway, because he's a vegetable, effectively. He's not non-corpus mentis. He's out of it. So his staff did it, which, of course, his administration is controlled by Jews. They don't have a particular affinity to Christianity. But yeah, he chose March 31st as Transgender Visibility Day. The excuse was it's always been Transgender Visibility Day. Don't you remember when you were a kid, Joe?
Oh, yeah.
With your family celebrating Trans Visibility Day?
I remember. It was like Christmas, Easter, 4th of July, and Trans Visibility Day.
What are you?
Because we had so many transvestites in my neighborhood.
Yes, they were just everywhere. It would come out, and the whole community would get together. It's when America was all unified by trans.
Barbecues and fireworks. It was terrific.
It's always been transvisibility. It's like, I don't think I ever turned transvisibility to last year. It's the first time I heard the term. Nevertheless, he denied doing it in the press conference. He was asked why he chose that. But obviously, this is just typical of the antipathy, the hate, the contempt that our government has towards traditional Christianity, normal people in general. This is so absurd. Why would you celebrate something so some artificial and perverse and weird as transgenderism, which doesn't really exist other than someone's psychosis or vanity or whatever, or narcissism. And it's being promoted by all the usual suspects. I saw one tweet, it was interesting. He compared, we don't spend too much time because we obviously know what's going on here. How the White House treats other holidays. Hanukkah. Lighting the menorah is a reminder. This is what Joe Biden tweeted, or at least his office did. I doubt he did this. On Hanukkah, he says, lighting the menorah is a reminder to hold on to the miracles of hope and faith, because when we do, no night is so dark that we can't find the light. Happy Hanukkah. Ramadan. Tonight, as a new crescent moon marks the beginning of the Islamic holy month of Ramadan, Jill and I extend our best wishes. I'm sure he thinks about it every day to Muslims across our country and around the world, except for those in Palestine. Kwanzaa, who was, I think this was created in 1960s by a guy who used to beat his wife. Kwanzaa, we begin with 7 days of Kwanzaa. Jill and I send our best wishes. I'm sure they're celebrating Kwanzaa. As we begin the 7 days of Kwanzaa, Jill and I are send our best wishes to everyone celebrating. May this time of reflection on the rich heritage of African-American culture bring peace, unity, and joy. This is what he writes about Easter, of course. Now, therefore, I, Joseph Biden Jr., President of the United States of America, by virtue of authority vested in me by the Constitution and the laws of the United States, do hereby proclaim March 31st, 2024, Trans Day of Visibility. He made no acknowledgement of Easter. So there's no separate acknowledgement, at least not the
one that everyone caught the obvious propaganda aspect of this. Mm-hmm. Because remember, Easter is, you know, the for Christians, it is resurrection and the appearance, right? The visibility of Christ after.
Yes, it's the most important holiday on the Christian calendar.
But here, so this is really, inversion, where now the transvestite is being put in the place of Jesus Christ.
Yeah, it's transvaluation, yes.
Well, that's right. But yeah. I mean, this is the visibility of the transgender is on, you know, he's like resurrected somehow from the mm-hmm. cultural death that, repressive Western society. Now he's being, he's resurrecting, he's coming out of the tomb. And the idea that this was accidental, well, it's like one chance in 365, so I'm not going to take that too seriously. It was obviously selected. The date was selected, not by Biden. He doesn't have the brain for this kind of perverse propaganda, but someone selected it who has the power to do such things. And it's done deliberately. It's a psychological attack on people who are Christian. And it is a foreshadowing of the religion that they have in mind, in which, I mean, imagine, transvestite disco queen replacing Jesus Christ as the foundation of your culture.
Yeah.
You know, it's not complicated. It's right in our face, so to speak. It's visible, to use an expression. Mm-hmm. So there it is. That's what they did. And Christians should look at this and realize just how serious the situation is. The people in political power are actually now, mocking openly your religion and indicating that they're going to turn your world into a transvestite story hour.
Yep. And I guess following on this line or on this theme, the famous atheist and evolutionary biologist Richard Dawkins explained that he identifies as a cultural Christian. In an interview, learning that Ramadan lights were being hung on the street of the United Kingdom as opposed to hanging lights for celebrate Easter. So this is a good example of expunging Christianity doesn't create a neutral public square or vacuum. It gets filled by something else. It's being filled by Muslims. The mayor of London, Sadiq Khan, turned on 30,000 lights for Ramadan for the Muslim holy month. but there was no acknowledgement of Easter on Oxford Street. He said, "I must say I'm slightly horrified to hear that Ramadan is being promoted instead," Dawkins said in an interview with Rachel S. Johnson of the LBC Sunday. "I feel that we are a Christian country. It's true that statistically the number of people who actually believe in Christianity is going down, and I'm happy with that, but I would not be happy if, for example, we lost our cathedrals and our beautiful parish churches, so I count myself a cultural Christian. I think it would be matter if we substituted any alternative religion. That would be truly dreadful," he told the media outlet. So after devoting his career to mocking, devaluing Christianity, promoting atheism, he laments its effects of of de-Christianizing Great Britain. Again, a little naive on his part to think that to just be in the wake of Christianity being expunged, it'd be a vacuum where everyone could just be free. And, you know, obviously it's going to be filled with something else. Again, it's he thinks you can have Christianity, cultural artifacts, it affects Christianity without the faith. And of course, that's very naive. If anything, the churches in the West, largely the Protestant churches, have followed his kind of model, embracing all the liberalism. And of course, as because of that, the pews are now empty and Protestantism is now dying. Of course, much of Catholicism has embraced this stuff, although not officially in its doctrine. It's just infiltrated. So there's a big difference there. But nevertheless, what did he expect? I mean, it's almost like when I hear John Cleese lament the fact of what's happening in London. It's just, what did you expect was going to happen with your taunting and your mocking of everything that was decent for decades? I mean,
isn't it funny? Everyone knows that they want to live inside Christian culture.
Yes.
And it's self-evident, right? It's the only culture that really, it's virtually the only culture that has the kind of levels of civilization that, you know, there is kind of peace on the street, you know,
yes.
High trust culture. However, no one has come up with a way to produce that culture without using Christianity, right? I mean, where would that be? So therefore, they criticize Christianity, but they want to live in Christian culture. Unfortunately, this is just a mechanical contradiction, because you ain't going to get Christian culture if you mock, taunt, and evaporate Christianity. And believe me, this is a dilemma that I, you know, through my work, I experience this all the time. And mm-hmm. I don't think that, I do not see a way to kind of culture that, will actually work without Christianity or some form of European.
This has been a vanity since the Enlightenment that you could, Enlightenment, of course, is basing on Christian presuppositions without Christianity, that you can maintain a decent, orderly society. Even John Adams, who said that our Constitution doesn't function in the absence of a moral people. So you have people in charge, like the Biden administration, who's running them, the NGOs, the oligarchs who run the foundation. We'll talk about the open society and all this, but if they're dedicated in the interest of creating a liberal society and a moral society, if you have a society that's governed, that's controlled by people who are dedicated to making society immoral, the Constitution no longer functions, the system no longer functions, the society breaks down. Then what do you have?
To digress, I think you could have like a moral kind of high trust culture in a small community, something like the size of an Athenian city state. I think this is possible. I mean, they seem to have pulled it off. But I think if you have large scale civilization mm-hmm. structures like Rome, you just can't do it unless you have a religion that is widespread and promotes moral behavior.
Right? Yeah, I mean, the Romans had Stoicism, right?
They did, actually. Right. Yeah.
So there was a code. I mean, there was a sense of morality.
It worked for a bit, but as soon as you got into the imperial cult and man gods, the thing was just started to teeter. So the whole upscale of Rome was when it was using the Stoic religious principles, and then as soon as you got to now the Caesar and the man god, it was just straight downhill.
Well, the further it got from its pastoral state of the Republic, it got further. I mean, we can talk about this, the amass of wealth and power, you get detached from reality,
Exactly. And so Rome is really a good example of the problem that I see. You want to have the culture of the high trust culture, but then you don't have a way to have a universal high trust, kind of animating religion.
One thing also, he's so smart, but he doesn't talk about why it's happening. And we'll talk about this. There is an operation afoot. It's called the Open Society.
And
this has been a plan, you know, for decades, if not centuries, but nevertheless, in the 20th century, we had this. We had a concept of the open society that I think it was written during World War II by Karl Popper. He was born in Vienna to I think Popper's grandparents were Jewish, but his parents converted to Lutheranism, and he became a very influential philosopher in the 20th century. And he wrote what's a book called Open Society and Its Enemies during the Second World War, I think, which is interesting because that was sort of the idea of anything supporting nationalism, social cohesion, patriotism was considered sort of you're a Nazi or a fascist, anything opposing liberalism. So it's his sort of his book praising the importance of liberalism. But behind that, you kind of see a sort of a Jewish agenda, despite the fact he wasn't Jewish, really, but again, he was a converter, which raises all types of questions for obvious reasons. But he was pushing the Jewish agenda with the Open Society. We see it now with Open Society Foundation, which we can talk about. But Karl Popper, you've done some research on this guy.
I have, and I think he's one of these critical kind of Jewish sophists, you know, that you have to understand, particularly now since the Open Society, you know, Soros's group is so influential in Europe and in the United States. You got to know a little bit about where it comes from, what the terms mean. Popper, you know, as you say, he was from a Jewish family, but his family really gives you an indication as to what he is. I mean, the first thing about Popper is that his father was a very high level Freemason, not just a, you know, run of the mill attend, you know, the law. He was a high level Freemason. He was a member of Humanitas Lodge, which was the oldest and most malevolent of all the Freemason lodges. So this is his direct background. His mom was a Schiff, the banking family Schiff. She's a Schiff. She's directly related, though her immediate parents, they weren't banking family members, but, you know, just one generation to the side. There they are. There's the banking family. So this is his background. You have Freemason. And the Schiff family, and of course, you know, the Schiffs were, they lived in the house with the Rothschilds. Mm-hmm. You know, the banker who, Adam Schiff, who became the Rothschild agent in the United States, he was literally born in the Rothschild household. So, you know, this is you know, how closely aligned the families are. So this is her family background. Their close friends were the Freud family, right? Freud's sister Rosa was a constant house guest, you know, and so you get an idea of literally what Popper is coming from. Okay, so I want to you know, also point out that his uncle, Joseph Popper, was one of the very first Jewish Zionists. Now, you know, we've talked about how you have the proto-Zionists, which are all Freemason, starting with Palmerston in 1840. But that phase lasted for like 40 years, and then it transitions to Herzl, you know, with Jewish, they were started to put Jews in their role as the advocates of Zionism. And one of the very first ones was Joseph Popper, his uncle. Now, Joseph Popper was really outspoken, and he articulated this whole, you know, philosophy. He said that Jews can only be saved from anti-Semitism if they possess their own state. The creation of such a state is so urgent that the type of regime in the beginning does not matter.
Okay, so problem solved now? Problem solved? They have their own state, right? Problem solved?
Yeah, problem solved. Now, this is just fascinating because you can understand that at this point in 1880, before Zionism was really took a hold of the Jewish consciousness totally in Europe, the Jews were actually merging with European culture. And that's why Reform Judaism, which was the popular Judaism of the era, was so opposed to Zionism and actually organized themselves against it, but they couldn't stand against the money and the political power of the Zionist Jews, who were, you know, obviously funded by the Rothschilds and the British Freemasons. So they couldn't stand against them. They got replaced. But at the time that Popper is claiming that we must have this Jewish state, it's so urgent, there really wasn't the kind of pogrom world, you know, that he's talking about. It's just the opposite. So So there's obviously something wrong with his analysis.
Well, year is this? Late 19th century?
Yeah, this is like 1880.
Okay, this is coinciding with the mass migration of Jews out of the Pale, and a lot of these Jews were
exactly. That's right.
Talmudic,
That's a whole Masonic project. We'll have to discuss at some point. But anyway, so Popper, Uncle Popper, is like, he's saying, you know, we've got to have the Jews got to be saved from anti-Semitism. And of course, he never mentions the possibility, the strange idea that, well, maybe we could just change our behavior so that people wouldn't hate us so much. You see, he never, ever mentions the idea that, well, maybe it's undemocratic how we approach banking, how we approach the political power of our tiny minority. I mean, he never mentions the possibility that there could be anything incorrect about Jewish behavior. It's all anti-Semitism. It's all, you know, the Gentiles are the only group that's capable of doing something wrong. Now, this is important because you have Popper's, you know, his scientific philosophy. And Tim, I mean, it is tip to stern mumbo jumbo. I mean, it is like almost worse than Blavatsky, except instead of talking about spiritual stuff, he's talking about science, but it's just mumbo jumbo. And you wonder, well, why would someone even waste their time, you know, writing this kind of stuff down? But you have to remember what he's actually doing is he's saying that, you know, Plato, you know, with this strong kind of ethnic structure to republics, this is bad. This creates, it can create totalitarianism. This is how he explained it. Mm-hmm. And so he argued that after the mumbo jumbo, after the kind of this long 2,000 pages of mumbo jumbo, he goes, you know, we've got to stop German nationalism because it has a strong affinity with the revolt of reason and the open society. So the open society is a society that doesn't have a Gentile national identity. And that he called that the idea that the territory of every state should coincide with the territory inhabited by one nation or ethnic group is a myth, an irrational and utopian dream of naturalism and tribal collectivism. These are fancy words to say, you know, bad behavior.
Wait. How is it a myth if they exist?
Well, he right. It's a good point. He's saying
ever hear of Ireland? I mean,
he's using myth in the Popper sense of like it's a mythological intellectual construction. In other words, it's irrational.
Okay, so it has no organic basis.
Because he's saying, he's saying it's myth. Okay. But you have to remember, so Popper is talking about German nationalism as irrational and tribal collectivism. It's just this very bad idea. But Uncle Popper is at the very same time. He's going, no, we got to have our own state. This is absolutely critical. We have, it's an urgent need. And I don't even care. We may need to put a king in place to get this thing together. We don't even need a democracy, you know?
So you're citing the contradiction here.
I'm pointing out there's a little contradiction.
Yeah.
And I'm pointing out that if you look at his background with Masonic, you know, and then the Freudian connection, I mean, Freud is another example of 10,000 pages of mumbo jumbo. And what you end up with is, well, sexual restraint is neurotic.
Yes.
So we got to get rid of that. Now,
The way, that's what the other day I was Rabbi Shmuley. Ever heard of him? You know, Shmuley, the guy who.
Shmuley, yeah.
He was on Alex Jones' show. Alex
screamer,
Jones.
Yeah, the screamer, yeah.
Yeah, Alex Jones was pushing back on what he was saying and he basically criticizing for what his activism, making a clown of himself. And this is right out of the authoritarian personality, right out of Freud. So he's being really Jewish here. Surprise, surprise, Rabbi Shmuley. He says that Alec Jones is sexually repressed. In odd sense, the sexual repression is the source of his conservative, you know, politics. It's an interesting admission there, I thought, in that exchange.
That's fascinating. Yeah, yeah. They would have that concept.
You're so sexually repressed. Alec Jones, I don't think Alec Jones was pointing out, you know, the clowners. You know, sexual banter that he engages in. You're sexually repressed, so any expression of decency or notion of the obscene or, you know, is repression in his mind. So,
but anyway, so it's fascinating that with Freud, you have, you know, remember the authoritarian personality leads to the propaganda of Eros, right?
Mm-hmm.
The end of sexual restraint. To get there, you have the understanding that European ethnic identity is irrational and dangerous, right? So you've got in Popper, you have the authoritarian personality kind of prototype, where you've got the connection to Freud and the sexual end of sexual restraint, which of course is the end of the family. And then at the same time, you have like a stream of sophistry so that Gentiles should see that their desire to have a kind of what he called tribal collectivism, mm-hmm. which would be like ethnic political power, I think would be another way of expressing that concept. But so you have exactly what then gets, well, not exactly, but it's just another way of saying what then gets repeated in the authoritarian personality. And so basically you've got this longstanding kind of way of that Jewish intellectuals are trying to structure the Gentile mind, you see. And the open society is just a terrific way of understanding what their end goal is. There you have no identities. There are no ethnic identities. There's not even any gender identities, basically, that are left. They're just these individual souls floating around. But none of that gets applied to the Jews. None of that. So the open society is a society wherein Jews have ethnic identity and ethnic political power, and no one else does. So that's the open society, and that is the process that Popper and Freud and Adorno and et cetera, all these guys have been engaged in for a couple hundred years.
Yeah, it's interesting that because this was written in 1944, 1940, I think it's published 1945, so it's during the Second World War, so it's in that, you know, time. Environment, political environment, where Nazi Germany is being pathologized as being the most, you know, vile thing that ever was created, and of course fascism and these things were a reaction to the, you know, the apparent failures of liberalism in the early 20th century with the Great Depression and the political turmoil that grew out of the First World War. You have to put these things in context, and so, you know, obviously National Socialism, Nazi Germany, the Hitler regime, was a virulent reaction. But what was it reacting to? That should be part of the discussion, to say the least, at the very least, before you start, you know, condemning all ideas of ethnic identity and nation states and, you know, ethnic based states, which is a based on a cultural identity and affinity, is a good way to organize the political community and defend your interests, as opposed to like an open society where anyone can come in. There's no common sense of right and wrong or moral values. It's all about commerce and trading. Yet there's only one group, like the Jews, who can maintain their cultural cohesion, their tribal cohesion and organization. They're allowed to discriminate, engage in circular economies and nepotism. No, but no one else is, because if you call them out for doing that, you're an anti-Semite. That's the only thing that the open society isn't open to. It's interesting. Everything else they're open to, and so Popper, okay, Lutheran, parents converted to Judaism, but he's still a Jew. He's arguing for Jews because he's arguing for liberalism. And liberalism is a chosen ideology of Jews because it basically they present themselves operating in good faith and goodwill. And they're not doing anything in secret. They don't have any hidden ulterior motives. Well, we know that isn't true. And if, the moment you try to apply any scrutiny to their activity or call out their organizations, they condemn you as anti-Semitic. And they try to expunge you from society, cancel you, even throw you in jail, even worse. But we, you know, like I've said this before, it's only natural if you're adults and you're engaged politically in your society, you want to know what's going on, you're going to question the ulterior motives of these people, of any power group, Jew or non-Jew. There was open discussion about the WASP power elite, the WASP elite, the old boy network, so much so that it's gone now. It was so criticized. It was superseded by the Jewish elite, but you can't criticize the Jewish elite, you know, but as they advocate for things like civil rights, which is, you know, again, everything is these moral crusades that are just shields for their own agenda. The Holocaust cult, their advocates for open immigration, sexual revolution or sexual liberty, if you will. All that is breaking down identity, moral, promoting immorality, which leads to breakdown of social cohesion. Yeah.
All of that is, of course, completely forbidden in Israel. everything that is being applied and demanded of all of the heritage European countries in Europe and the United States, none of that ever would be permitted in Israel, where in fact they're actually genociding a dark skin population right now, right? To create an ethnic tribal zone that is free of any other human. And no one else has any political power. There's no way that you could. So this is a, I think it's as clear as it can be. You know, the situation in Gaza has clarified the world in a way that, I mean, I don't know how words could ever, you know, create that kind of clarity. But the one thing that is the dam holding humanity's stream of analysis from understanding the condition it's sitting in is the Holocaust. If that thing gets, you know, if that thing gets unplugged, believe me, the understanding of the world will become very, very vivid for the vast majority of the world. And this is why, you know, when people, you know, people are discouraged and they go, oh, look, you know, the oligarchs have got, you know, technology and the internet, and they can create, you know, they can control Google and stuff. Look at the percentage of young people that don't buy the Holocaust, right? And look at the protests, how vivid they were, you know, during the Palestinian, when the Palestinian genocide began. All that you need is to unravel the Holocaust a little bit so people can start thinking about it as Jewish sophistry and Jewish propaganda and not Gentile criminality. You see, that one bit, if that gets flipped, then the power of the human mind will just roll forward from that point, and suddenly you'll start having lots of people go, you know, that just makes no sense, the way that, you know, you're trying to set up the United States. That this doesn't look real as trying to benefit the heritage American population. This looks like an agenda to destroy it. So yeah. I'm optimistic that we can actually flip that bit.
Well, I mean, you look out the window, it looks like the world's falling apart. Our country, America, the United States was once, you know, a very pleasant country to live in my lifetime. I witnessed a profound change. The fracturing, you know, is occurring at alarming speed. Europe's turmoil is, you know, we expect to see it here if things continue apace. The, you know, the social destruction, the anarchy we're seeing is so profound. There's this toxic mix of, you know, disturbed, unhinged people coupled with growing totalitarian and sort of a collectivist mindset by the regime, you know, cancel culture, assaults on free speech. This is done by government, big media, large corporations. This is the regime. So we just can't look at the government. We have to look at the corporations, NGOs, large corporations, media. They're all connected. So that's the regime. Basically, with the open, this is a product, you know, of various agendas. You look at like something like the Open Society Foundation. It's named the Open Society Foundation for a reason, by George Soros' network, which is there to spread turmoil and chaos in the guise of freedom and progressivism. But what we're seeing now is we had the strange, this past 4 years, we had the strange mixture, juxtaposition of sort of this deranged, atomized individuals coexisting with a totalitarian collectivist mindset, with COVID-19, but they went right along with it. So end of the day, they didn't even believe in extreme atomism or individualism. But what it did do is it broke society down. There wasn't any meaningful resistance. So it's been effectively collectivized. So when you have a society where everyone is their own king or own can determine for themselves what's right and wrong, well, not everyone can be a king. Not everyone's a billionaire. So what you have is you have a bunch of atomized Satanists running around, but only a few people are able to impose their will because they control the media. They have the money to control the agenda, control the public discourse. When you do away with something like an idea of a common universal morality that everyone must adhere to, or at least publicly, you don't get a democratic situation. You get a totalitarian order because only the few who control the platforms can control public discourse. So you have that apparent irony there with that situation. But you do get the sort of the Open Society Foundation, which is promoting lawlessness with its, backing DAs, who are dedicated to not enforcing the law, not protecting property. And we see it just recently, like up in New York, Letitia James, or San Francisco, or Atlanta, these people were all Soros installed. The various activism, they're big. The Open Society Foundation was a big advocate for open borders. And also they played a big part in the destabilization of the former Warsaw Pact countries and also Soviet republics. And now once that was done, they started their activism in the West and destabilizing the West. And again, as I mentioned, if there was some meaningful opposition to this, like in Congress or in the courts or in, you know, if we had attorneys general who are aware of this, they could bring forth a RICO case against Open Society Foundation, against the ADL and other like organizations. They could subpoena evidence, you know, of communications, of tortious interference, of extortion, of breaking and entering and stealing information, blackmail. All this would be uncovered very easily if the force of law is brought down on these organizations. Because these are an organization like the ADL is an outlaw organization, meaning in the traditional sense, an outlaw was someone who wasn't just broke the law, was someone who's declared outlaw because he had violated norms of the community, of society, and they had violated in such a way that he was now excluded from the protection of the law. Something like that should be applied to something like the ADL, because they are outside the rules. When they advocate for censorship and they are tortious interference, ruin people's lives, blackmail, and believe me, a good serious investigation or activity. I mean, they got caught out in the 1990s in San Francisco. Police caught them stealing information, blackmail, and keeping intelligence files on people. And that was a blackmail operation. That's how they have their power. That's why they enjoy influence with the FBI and the Department of Justice, even before Merrick Garland was Attorney General. You know, so a real investigation would expose all this. And yeah, they should be declared outlaw. They don't play by the rules. We can't play this game of liberalism if the other side doesn't play by the rules. What you have to do is you have to exclude them from the game.
Right. I mean, that's exactly right. The open society is a society where they're able to use self-interested racial identity as the basis for their interpretation of laws, right? And they're able to use their self-centered kind of a desire for racial supersession as the basis for, you know, what they regard as morality. Mm-hmm. So all you really need to do, given how egregious their behavior is just expose it. So if we had a trial like you're talking about, it wouldn't even need to reach a conclusion. Just having the discovery, if you had like legitimate, smart attorneys going through what they're doing and demanding answers and getting depositions, I mean, the thing would just collapse. It can only exist in what we call the open society, which is, you know, as we define it and as we observe it, is that you have to have a Jewish political power and no other ethnic group with any political power. Then you can have the ADL. It can function, right? But if you have legitimate kind of other ethnic interests, you know, coming in and analyzing what they're doing and saying, well, hey, this is supersession. You're destroying us with your behavior and you're deliberately doing it. The thing will just, it could never function. It just wouldn't. So again, it's the way they've structured consciousness is the issue here. And the linchpin is the Holocaust. You know, that's where we are the ultimate victims. You, the Gentiles, you are always, committing crimes against us. We never commit crimes. You always commit crimes. That's just that is the bedrock of reality. That's the bedrock. If you actually had that analyzed and go, well, actually, we think you're committing crimes. Let's look at your behavior. Let's look at some evidence as to how you organize yourselves, then, you know, the public could then be the spell that we are under would be broken very quickly.
It is a spell in a sense.
It's a spell, yeah. So that's the thing, is they've constructed a spell with all of the fake historical stories, you know, that we're told. And they conducted it against Gentiles to set up the open society in Europe and the United States.
Yeah,
and
then, yeah. The liberal society can be bought out because it's all about dollars, right? And so they can buy the bunch of Jews corner, you know, industry like Hollywood or they were able to, through nepotism, take over finance, that they can leverage that wealth to buy up the nation's patrimony, and they have. That's
well,
why
once they have the control over the Federal Reserve, and of course, it's not, you can't audit it. They can create all the credit they need. So the power of money is their power. That's their
power.
The
usury is the gift that keeps on giving. It's the power of compound interest.
And then they create the narrative of the Holocaust to show we can't do anything wrong, and then they create the narrative of the Arab terrorist, right? You they don't talk about the attacks against the Arabs that the Zionists have been conducting for over 100 years. That's not, you can't discuss that. It's always, well, we're counterattacking against people who are trying to kill us. You know, this.
Oh, yeah. So, the Arab terror, that was like 1985 through 2001. Hollywood produced all those movies. I mean, it started with what, like Back to the Future with the crazy, crazy Libyans.
Yeah. And that's then, right. The Libyans were like trying to create an atomic bomb or something.
Yeah.
So just the brainwashing just goes on around the clock. But see where it ends up, in case people don't understand how dangerous this is.
What was it? True Lies with Arnold Schwarzenegger? And
right. I mean, it just time after time.
Executive Decision.
But then you end up with Gaza. And now they are actually destroying the, you know, children and women and aid workers and just slaughtering them all. And it's all because they call it the Israeli counterattack, the counterattack.
Well, as Golda Meir said, we should never forget them for making us kill their children.
Yes, that was the ultimate crime. So the thing is, they set up a pretext, the Holocaust, the Arab terrorists, you know, whatever they want to use. They enforce it through the media. And then when they go in for the kill, that's the camouflage so that the world doesn't, say, well, you've got to stop the behavior. We're going to step in here. So the spell that we're under makes the how irrational the world is, right, and how evil it is. We don't see it, and we don't respond to it as we should.
Yeah. Well, again, liberalism, open society, Karl Popper, of course, ethnically Jewish. You can see the pattern there. The Jews have always pushed, you know, liberalism, even libertarianism, sort of as a means to an end. Even, you know, the converso thing. They can convert to any religion in bad faith in pursuit of their interests. That's rabbis, you know, legitimized that, you know, 2,000 years ago. You could false conversion, but it's not just converting to Catholicism. It's converting to Islam. It's converting to liberalism, back to socialism, back to communism. So they'll take, you know, it's a form of like ideological or philosophical shapeshifting, pursue their interests. So that's why you had something like libertarianism that was promoted since the 1960s in America, sort of a reaction to the excesses of the New Deal, World War II, and Great Society, you know, this that was going on at the time. But someone like Ayn Rand, also Jewish, would, you know, knew that Jewish power would grow greatly if ethnic whites were deracinated and atomized, while Jews maintain their tribal consciousness.
Right.
That's why Ayn Rand was a big advocate of Israel.
Well, of course.
She declared Arabs to be, you know, primitive and Israel sophisticated and modern.
Yeah, well, she's a huge racist. And then look at the mumbo jumbo.
Yeah.
Look, just like with Popper or Freud, you've got like a ream of mumbo jumbo, which just puts people to sleep who are, you know, mentally clear-minded. But at the end of it, she comes up with this cult of the individual, right? The cult of the individual. This is, again, it's very subtle, but you can see how it all works against ethnic collective, political power. She sets up the cult of the individual. You've got to be, you know, your own person, the things which are pulling you, you know, toward this collective behavior or weakness. You know, you must be, you know, to be like completely manifesting your genius that you have. You want to just be part of a cult of yourself, you know, the individual. Well, you know, I mean, you can plug Ayn Rand right into the authoritarian personality, into Popper, into Freud, all these other mumbo jumbo specialists. And what you end up with is that, you know, we want all of the European people to be isolated. And that means no families, pornography, you know, just that's what you get in terms of your sexuality. And on the other hand, where is, so Ayn Rand was a huge supporter of Israel. Look at what a hive mind Israel is, right?
Yeah.
About that. Where was her criticism of that? Right. There's plenty of criticism of the you know, well, we are the Europeans don't understand they should be cult of individuals. Popper, you know, his uncle is manifesting Zionism in an extreme way. Well, where is the, if they want to apply these, you know, kind of the critical theory to Gentiles, it's obvious that they're not applying it to themselves. This should be, whenever they do that, whenever they apply the critical theory against, you know, Gentiles, that like everything you do is wrong, your culture is just terrible, and, you know, it's all, and the, you should immediately respond with the idea, well, can we see this analysis that you're giving to me that you've done in the past against Israel? Because this is really right now the prime example of everything you seem to be opposing. So naturally, I'm sure there's going to be lots of example of you criticizing Israel for this kind of behavior, this tribalism, this racism, this self-centeredness, right? Where is your the literature of your criticism? And there just never is any. So this is our indicator as to what they actually are doing. It's an attack. It's not, it's just sophistry. It's just a kind of, you know, the whole mumbo jumbo world, Tim, is just a lump of sophistry. It's all nonsense. And, well, and the whole point of it is just to make Europeans isolated and weak.
Yeah, the appeal of the open society, of a liberal society, or even libertarianism, is that a lot of, I think, Gore, libertarians thought that individualism was for everybody and everyone would become sort of a atomized, deracinated individual regarding himself or, you know, primarily as an individual, as me, myself. That's all that matters, really. And I can pursue what I want to do. Everything else, you know, national loyalty, religious faith or affiliation, kinship with the group, even racial identity, even sexual identity, sexual reality, yeah, et cetera, would be secondary to the individual, meaning that you're not bound by nature or bound by some moral code that defines you, defines the past, tells us, defines the present, and tells us the future. These sort of things. Just about me right now. So all that matters is now. Well, that wasn't true because it was assumed that all other groups would also move in this direction, because under every one, you scratch a black person, you scratch a brown person, there's a libertarian. There's like a liberal waiting to come out if you provide the proper environment. Well, that's just silly. Of course, they're not libertarians, but just when ethnic whites were being deracinated, moving to the suburbs and being told to be individuals at the expense of all the considerations that I talked about, Jews were exploiting or promoting the Holocaust cult and Zionism and Jewish values. So my point is they're at the same time the majority is being told to be individuals, they're coalescing, they're slowly taking, we talked about the that article last week, how the golden age of the Jews is ending. The author cites all this Jewish accomplishment influence in America, which is just code word for the Jewish takeover of America. Then he says anyone who is critical of the Jewish power in America is an anti-Semite. So, I mean, again, it's like, yeah, basically, whites are told, ethnic whites, they have no identity other than a negative identity, meaning what they're guilty of. So that's that they have an identity. Other groups have a positive identity because these other groups are largely proxies for Jews, because those other groups, like blacks, browns, if you will, don't have the agency to really control, to execute any political power, whereas the white majority does if it has identity. So they want to smash it all. So it's a con, you know.
That's exactly right. That's well said.
It's a trick.
And so, you know, we just have to flip the bit on the Holocaust. The material to do it is right in front of us. Rudolph should really, I mean, anyone who doesn't support that guy is out of their minds. I mean, mm-hmm. Rudolph really needs to be supported because his work is, the encyclopedia is just amazing. And so is Butts. They approach the problem from different perspective and they bring different strands of evidence, but mm-hmm. both of them really show the Holocaust as being the gas chamber extermination of 6 million Jews is a absolute propaganda piece of nonsense. So this refutation of the sophistry is out. It's there. Rudolph and Buss have done the work, and both of them have put their material online. This stuff should just be shared everywhere. And any kind of Gentile intellectual, purported Gentile intellectual, people should demand that this become their platform, that they should demand that, you know, since I'm here in the public space, I want to bring up the idea of a committee of Holocaust, objective analysis of what actually happened, because there is now a whole body of evidence which contradicts, you know, the mainstream narrative on this. And if we do it over and over and over again, the power of Holocaust and Holocaust denial will start to just erode, and that will open up the floodgates of the other analysis of the open society, you know, which is the political arm of the process, where you get to the open society. And Tim, this shouldn't be too hard to get people interested in, at least they should be interested in, because we can see what the open society can create now. When they bring up these concepts like feminism or Marxism or whatever it is they're trying, they give us to obtain political power, there's always the workers' paradise that's being held out. The open society is another workers' paradise. But all we have to do is look inside where the open society has had most purchase, and we can now see what it actually creates. Tim, it creates the autonomous zone. It creates the fentanyl brigade. It creates, fractured, broken cities that are just completely filled of drug addicts and violence and absolutely no retail space and criminality, you know, and lack of any kind of cult of, and I'm using it in the good term here, cult of self-restraint or of any kind of trust in society. You know, I was looking at this break-in. It wasn't a break-in, it was a robbery in a convenience store. And the convenience store owner said that when he confronted the youths, he was to leave them alone or they would report him. They would report him, you see. So this is where the open society leads. It just leads to, you know, like a cesspool of chaos and violence, where physically strong, violent young males can take any liquor they want, rape people, and then report those who, you know, try to restore moral order. So we know where the open society takes us. There's enough experience with it now that we should not let them hold out this fantasy workers' paradise that they claim they're going to bring, and demand that they actually start talking about the motivations, the ethnic motivations that are in back of, trying to hoist something that's so stupid and destructive on top of our culture.
Yeah, you're right about that. We're sort of in a post-ideological age, because there's no point in arguing or debating or belaboring the various isms that were presented, whether it's transgenderism, socialism, feminism, environmentalism, socialism. These things are just leading to the decaying of society and plunging
us. We can see it now. It's obvious.
Yeah. The criminality, you just cite the chaos and all that. With the open society, what you really get is we get open pornography, open homosexuality, open divorce, open fornication, open drug use. We are seeing our very society transformed into a third world country. Actually, even in terms of the population, because the open borders leads to that. It's open society, open borders. How is a political unit going to organize itself if there's open borders that's being inundated with people from all these other countries with all their problems, which make their countries as bad as they are? And this, of course, this says nothing about what these policies result in sort of a we're seeing now with U.S. debt, this bankrupt fiscal policies that are being pursued, and all prudence is cast aside, all thrift is forgotten. And so we're becoming a nation of hedonists in the true sense of the word. And we don't think of yesterday. We don't, and we have no regard for tomorrow, for paternity. So there's no sense, again, I'm sorry, posterity. So we we're just our atomized, deracinated state. All we just live for today. Well, there's no future if that. We always have to, because any society has to have a high sense of, has have time horizons that promote delayed gratification, and that's something that we just don't do anymore. That's look at the debt. It's just paying, making future generations pay for with a mounting debt, and that's what the open society creates. That's the practical reality. Despite its false promises,
You end up ultimately with the young men on the front line, marching into automatic weapon fire.
Yes,
this is what, like in the Ukraine or even in Palestine.
Yeah, maybe think of if someone showed me. I think it was Google. I forgot what word it was. Conspiracy or something, and it said it's harbored by certain neurotic belief that your government may not have your best interest. Yeah. I said, just like to have that statement and just picture of men going over the top in automatic weapon fire.
Well, incidentally, a Popper had as one of kind of the irrational structures conspiracy theory, which
that's like Richard Hofstadter, right? The paranoid style of American thinking, where they're pathologizing. The idea of being skeptical or scrutinizing your leaders, thinking that those in power may not have your best interests at heart, that's paranoid. That's rich coming from Jewish philosophers, I tell you that.
Right. Funny. But I mean, I know Popper actually had a whole critique of what he called the conspiracy theory of society. In fact, I wonder if he didn't actually come up with the expression that the CIA borrowed from him. But Popper, he wrote, he talked about the conspiracy theory of society, which he said was just the view that an explanation of a social phenomena consists in discovery of the men or groups who are interested in the occurrence of the phenomena.
And his father was a Freemason.
Right, exactly. So, I mean, right. Yeah, funny, isn't it odd? I mean,
and Jewish.
Right. But, you kind of, Popper, actually, I have to admit, I find him kind of amusing. I mean, this shows you how pitiful my social life is. I would actually spend time with this, but I mean, you just look at his language, he just makes everything so complicated and kind of impossible to really get. You can't see the malevolent sophistry in back, like an explanation of a conspiracy theory is an explanation of a social phenomena, that is this nonsense that a men or group are interested in the occurrences of this phenomena, so. You go, well, why isn't this rational? Why would that be a category of fantasy or of, something that's impossible? Why can't we look at conspiracy theory that he's describing just as, well, this is just how it's a tool of, the oligarchs?
Well, what gets me is that just a cursory examination of certain historical events, not a cursory, just a little more than a cursory examination of things like the outbreak of the First World War, the diplomatic maneuverings and intrigues that led to the Second World War, the Cold War. We all know that the causes for these events, for these wars, these divisions, these crises or issues are never what's retailed to the public. So at some level, all these things involve some level of conspiracy because there's special interest. Whether it's the interest of the Jewish lobby or the WASP elite or the bankers, if you will, or something, or the intelligence communities, they're pursuing agendas that are not open to public scrutiny. That by definition is a conspiracy.
Yes.
And that's how the world turns. I'm sorry. I mean, anything less than a superficial childish view of the world knows the reality of the world is that the world history has been shaped largely by various conspiracies.
That's just how our yes. reality exists. It is the sum total of the conspiracies that shaped civilization before us.
Yeah. I mean, does anyone really think the United States got involved in the Vietnam conflict because of the domino theory, which was retailed to the public? No one believes that. Was there a Gulf of Tonkin? Was it a response to the Gulf of Tonkin attack? No, because the Dolphin attack never occurred. That's a conspiracy.
Yeah. Hey, can buildings fall straight down at freefall speed because there's a fire burning? So it has to be a conspiracy.
I mean, do you think Israel's 6-month war of ethnic cleansing in Gaza is a response to October 7th?
Right.
Does anyone believe that Israel accidentally killed 200 aid workers?
Right. Incredible how one accident after another.
Yes.
The building falls straight down and 200 aid workers are killed. These are just amazing kind of accidents that are all improbable, but this is just, it's like Noam Chomsky, you know, well, just stuff happens. I can't explain it. Stuff happens, you know. Well, actually, conspiracies happen. And we are in a vast conspiracy. And it's one that uses propaganda to shape our mind to cast the spell.
He'll say something like Kennedy assassination. Yeah, there's problem with the official narrative, but it's so long ago, we can't do anything about it anymore. Okay, move on.
Right.
What the heck?
Yeah. Well, anyway,
the nation state of Israel. You know, sorry, that was a conspiracy.
Yeah, you know,
its creation was a conspiracy.
Obviously, because
they write about it now. They brag about, you know.
I mean, look, you have like a Palmerston setting off, you know, the Zionism.
Yeah.
A meme like in 1840. Well, what's this all about? You have like 40 years of Freemason Zionism. And then when Hussein is negotiating with the British they want him to like use their Arab fighters against, you know, the Germans and the Ottomans. And who are they talking to? Who is Hussein having this communication with? Old McMahon.
Yeah.
He's the head Freemason of the region. And then no one can understand what, well, I mean, Hussein, the Arabs couldn't understand why he goes back on his word, why he creates the Balfour, which is the Freemason.
Well, the Balfour Declaration is an open, well, it's a letter. Right. So presumably it was private at the time, wasn't it?
Yeah, of course.
And why was public, it, so why, that was a conspiracy.
Write it to Rothschild, for God's sake. So there
it's
is.
It's a promise to get a country, the United States, into the war. That's a conspiracy.
Yes. Yeah.
It's not being openly debated with the American people. No one's saying in order to a secure Palestine for a Jewish homeland that America's been manipulated into the war. Hey, America, want to get involved? No, they bring up things like, you know, unrestricted submarine warfare and you know, the Kaiser looks like a gorilla and he's carrying women.
You know? They keep the spell, you know, strong with the term. They create like Holocaust denier, conspiracy theorist, truther, you know. You know that they're hiding a conspiracy when they create a term that becomes part of the common vernacular.
Yes.
This is how you know that, well, there's down to be a conspiracy at the back of that.
Was the King David bombing a conspiracy? Was the Levant affair a conspiracy?
Yeah.
Yes. And these are big events in the creation and the expansion of the state of Israel.
Yeah.
You know, so there you go. So much for that. So Karl Popper, take that.
Take that.
So, okay, Joe.
Tim, thank you so much, and we'll get him again next week.
Take care. Bye-bye.
You too. Bye-bye.